WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. President Trump is at an impasse with Democrats over funding for a full wall to separate the U.S. from Mexico. And he visited the southern border yesterday to make his case once more.
The Democrats are holding us up because they don't want it. They think it's good politically. I think it's a disaster for them politically. But I'm not doing it for politics. I'm doing it because it's right.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has dismissed his pleas for $5.7 billion, giving Trump the legislative equivalent of the Heisman.
The fact is, the women and children at the border are not a security threat. They are a humanitarian challenge, a challenge that President Trump's own cruel and counterproductive policies have only deepened.
U.S. officials have urged various strategies for the 800,000 federal employees who aren't being paid to get through the shutdown, to barter errands for rent, to hold yard sales, even to apply for unemployment benefits. Jamie Rodney, an investigator for the U.S. Housing and Urban Development Department, said at a protest that workers can't just make adjustments.
We have mortgage and rent to pay. We have student loans to pay. We have daycare costs to pay. We have car bills to pay. We have all of our bills to pay, and we need our paychecks now.
Join us. How is the shutdown affecting you? Are you a federal employee missing a paycheck today? Are you worried about losing government assistance or services? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us from Washington is David Nakamura. He's White House reporter for The Washington Post. David, good to talk to you again after so long.
Hey, David. Thanks. I appreciate, as a former sports writer, your use of the Heisman metaphor.
Doing what I can for you. Yeah. We also have here from Washington, Natasha Bertrand, staff writer for The Atlantic, covering national security, politics, and so much more. She joins us from D.C. Natasha, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, David.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, David, Natasha, and David.
I just want to start by playing another clip of somebody directly affected by this. Air traffic controller Melissa Hempson, she's a single mom who works in the Washington, D.C. area. She talked to NPR's Morning Edition today, and she said she resents not receiving a paycheck for working some of the busiest airspace in the world.
I'm working Air Force One. I'm not getting paid. I know a Secret Service isn't getting paid. I know that he's flying down the border. The TSA isn't getting paid. I know that the people on that airplane are getting paid. You know, that makes you think, like, what's the problem? Why is my paycheck being withheld?
David Nakamura, you cover the White House, the big he in that particular clip refers, of course, to President Trump. A lot of people feeling the pain. Who else is feeling the pain right now?
You know, President Trump appeared last week with Border Patrol agents as part of his public plea to get this border wall built. These were some of the leaders of the union, and they were saying they agree that a wall is necessary. But Border Patrol agents aren't getting paid, and there's another union that is suing the administration because their agents are not getting paid and are expected to work. I mean, this is the pressure is mounting on the president and Congress to come to some sort of resolution here. But public polls show that President Trump is taking more of the burden. He's the leader of the government. He's the chief executive. And he said very publicly in a televised meeting, we know, just before the shutdown, that he would be proud to shut down the government in the name of border security. The president's doubling down during his trip yesterday to the border. He believes that he's winning this shutdown, but I don't think the public polls necessarily show that.
Natasha Bertrand, this is we're on the precipice of being the longest shutdown in American history. It's a partial shutdown, but shutdown nonetheless. Is there any way in which there's a way out of all this?
Well, the only way out of this potentially right now, unless they come to some kind of compromise, is for the president to declare a national emergency. And we don't think that that would be the end of it necessarily either, because it would probably be challenged in the courts and there would just be a whole slew of consequences. And it could reopen the government, but it could also have detrimental impacts on, in terms of the partisan divide right now in this country. And, I think it's really important to point out that this has a really profound impact on national security. I mean, the FBI Agents Association came out yesterday with a really strong statement saying, look, you need to fund us, you need to restore funding, or else all of our investigations and projects are going to be severely limited. We can't really operate with these budget cuts. Our agents aren't getting paid, which could affect their ability to pay back their loans, their mortgages, et cetera, which could affect their ability to renew their security clearances. So this has a whole load of profound implications for people, not just in the FBI, but also TSA agents, air traffic controllers, more than half of the staff of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, which is a division of Homeland Security that's tasked with protecting our country's critical infrastructure, have been furloughed. So this needs to end. And entering into, what is it now, the 21st day of the shutdown, I think that what the president might do, because of all of this bad publicity he's getting, is potentially declare a national emergency.
Well, I want to turn to that in a moment. First, Jack Beattie, I want to talk a bit about what happened earlier this week on, I think it was Tuesday evening, the president decided to address the public from the Oval Office, hoping to rally folks to his side. Jack, how'd that go?
Well, it looked like one of those hostage videos, didn't it, that the president makes when his heart isn't in it. And he, in fact, earlier in the day said, my heart isn't in it. He confessed as much to network anchors. And the speech itself was a sort of farrago of false claims and hateful imagery. It raises the question of why did the networks make the time available? I mean, that may sound like a frivolous comment. He's the president. But, I think the dirty little secret of our television was put by Les Moonves, of all people, during the campaign when he said, Trump may be bad for the country, but he is sure good for us, good for their ratings. So the television, you know, the president is up to 6,000 falsehoods, let's call them lies. Mm-hmm. People knew that speech was going to be laden with them. It was clearly a political speech. Did any of the networks have the nerve to say, no, the president is befouling, he's bankrupting the coin of public discourse. We can't allow it. If he speaks truthfully, we will allow it, but we have to see the speech in advance. I'm sure the heavens would have fallen, but there would have been an assertion, at least, of the media trying not to just pass on Trump's propaganda.
Right. Well, it seemed as though because this was the first time it was from the Oval Office per se, they wanted to give him a once on that. Interesting to hear Les Moonves' controversy erupt over something that's from a non-personal scandal division. Nonetheless, we have a number of calls, people coming in, calling in about the shutdown. First, I want to take a call from Atlanta, Georgia. Jessica, go ahead.
Hi. This is
Hi.
Jessica. One thing that I have not heard discussed, my husband is impacted by this, but thank God we are fine financially, so we'll be okay. Mm-hmm. He's working without being paid. But here's the rub. Healthcare insurance is deducted from your paycheck. So if you are getting a zero balance paycheck, then eventually you're going to get a bill from your healthcare provider as far as who's providing the insurance to cover that. I have not heard anyone discuss that. So,
okay.
People being impacted financially.
Appreciate that, Jessica. I want to turn briefly to David Nakamura. Is there a sense that benefits are being impacted in a way like Jessica's family that could hurt people's, the kinds of things on which they depend beyond the paycheck week to week and month to month?
Yeah, David, what we know is that Trump's own advisors have acknowledged privately, and it's been reported that they were not prepared for the length of this shutdown and the effects that it had. It's a partial shutdown. So about one third of the government, 800,000 federal workers are furloughed, and many more contractors are not getting paid. It has significant impacts, we know, on the Park Service and other areas that you've already mentioned. But they are now scrambling to make patches and temporary fixes. They're trying to bring some people back to work, at least temporarily, without pay, because to provide critical services. And this is a really important issue. Trump has been very interesting. You know, when the federal government was shut down in 2013 under President Obama for 16 days over a fight over Obamacare and a funding bill at that time, President Obama wrote a long note to federal workers thanking them for their service, saying they didn't deserve to be part of this shutdown. President Trump's message to workers has not been so direct. And he's talked at times very politically about it, saying, you know, most of the people laid off are Democrats. And he was sort of trying to put pressure on Democrats to end the shutdown. The other day, he sort of flipped around and said, everybody's with me. They're going to get back pay. Everybody will be happy. I don't know that that's the way it works. Some people may, if they get back pay, they say, okay, well, fine. But I think the effects are happening now. We've reached basically the longest shutdown in U.S. history. I think pressure is mounting, and you're going to see some sort of movement from the White House fairly soon.
Natasha Bertrand, you mentioned a bit earlier the prospect of possible national emergency. President Trump said yesterday if the Democrats don't budge on funding a border wall, he might go around Congress and declare that state of national emergency in order to have the mechanism to build the wall.
I haven't done it yet. I may do it. If this doesn't work out, probably I will do it. I would almost say definitely.
Natasha Bertrand, what are the implications if he were to declare national emergency about this issue to accomplish that goal?
Right. Well, this would be subject to an immediate legal challenge by many parties, I would imagine. I mean, members of Congress have already said as much. So I don't know. I think that the most interesting part about this and about Republicans, many Republicans' support for the idea of declaring a national emergency and diverting those funds potentially from things like, you know, hurricane relief efforts, et cetera, that would go to places like Puerto Rico is fascinating because this is something that they criticized President Obama for doing and for, you know, they've typically been traditionally been opposed to government overreach of this kind. So I think it would
that is the executive exerting authority to make decisions without the approval of Congress.
Of Congress. Going around Congress is something that they've that conservatives have traditionally been categorically opposed
Natasha, really briefly, what is the implication of actually invoking the idea of an emergency around this issue for you? What does that do?
It's not a national emergency. It's a political issue, right? So this is an instance in which the president is using the concept of a national emergency, which should be taken extremely seriously, in order to get his way on a border wall that was a campaign promise. And so I think that it could have profound implications and set a really bad precedent for the future. For example, they were asked, a congressman was asked today, well, what if a future president wants to do it to invoke a national emergency with regard to climate change? And they couldn't really answer that. So
didn't have an answer. We're going to have answers to some of your other questions as we talk about this week's stories coming up. You can join our conversation. Who are you looking to for a solution to this stalemate? And if you're a supporter of the president, how would a failure to get funding for a border wall affect your support? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about the week's news. You can join our conversation. How critical is the border wall to the president's performance and the state of Republicans in Washington? What stock do you put on the revelation that Paul Manafort shared Trump's polling data in 2016 with Russian figures? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest today, Natasha Bertrand of The Atlantic, David Nakamura of The Washington Post, and On Point's Jack Beatty. A couple interesting moments this week. After President Trump's primetime address on Tuesday night, South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham had a message for his Republican colleagues as he was speaking over on Fox News.
This is the best chance we'll ever have to help President Trump get border wall funding, steel barrier funding, and at the same time fix the loopholes. The only way we lose is to give in. If we'll stand firm, put deals on the table that make sense, we will win this on behalf of the American people. But if we undercut the president, that's the end of his presidency and the end of our party, and we deserve to be punished if we give in now.
The very next day, President Trump met in the White House Situation Room with congressional leaders, and President Trump abruptly walked out of the meeting, not long into it, signaling his displeasure with the fact that the Democrats aren't showing any signs of yielding. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi stepped outside, and in talking with reporters, she described the meeting like this.
It's cold out here, and the temperature wasn't much warmer in the Situation Room. Our meeting did not last long.
We have a call from Des Moines, Iowa. Jonathan, please hop in here. Tell us your thoughts.
Thank you for taking my call. I don't support Trump. I am a first-generation American. My father came here from the Soviet-controlled territory, and he got nothing from this government. And my basic question, or I'd like to hear you guys talk about, is how much of this haranguing between Congress and the president is simply tit for tat with the way the Republicans treated Obama when Obama was trying to get health care for everybody. Because okay. I'm really sick of everybody in the government, not just.
I'm sick of everybody in government. Our call from Des Moines, Iowa, from Jonathan. Let's start with you, Jack Beatty. You know, this is $5.7 billion, a ton of money, and yet kind of a speck when it's compared to the, I think, trillion-dollar debt that we're reaching just for this year alone. What about the Democrats' refusal to give any money for the wall, even as they talk about their willingness to fund and support border security?
Yes, well, some of them are sort of echoing Jonathan. Democrats, you know, were very successful in suburban districts long held by Republicans. And those Democrats, as we read in the reporting, are saying, hey, wait a minute. We weren't elected from the Bronx. We were elected from, you know, the Philadelphia suburbs. We have to be cognizant of what voters in the middle, what Republican voters think, and we especially have to be cognizant of what federal employees are thinking, and can't we find some compromise? So there's been a lot of talk about the pressure on the Republican Senate, and there is, with senators defecting, at least rhetorically, but there's also pressure such as Jonathan is voicing on the Democratic side, people saying we got to give in here because it's going to hurt us politically.
You know, I mean, if you think about what the shutdown does, we came up with a very small list. But, you know, here are a couple examples of the kinds of things that are affected. There are low income housing subsidies right now that are not being renewed. I think more than 1,000 contracts providing federal subsidies to landlords who own and operate publicly sponsored housing. Food stamps are at risk if the shutdown goes past February. Unpaid TSA workers are calling out sick. You heard about a terminal in Miami. There are concerns that that will grow as an issue. And routine food inspections, they're not happening by the Food and Drug Administration, other than perhaps a resuming of the checks of the known riskiest foods for certain kinds of infections. These are real consequences. David Nakamura, talk about the Democrats, you know, the reason why this is something where they say this is a principle for us. We're not going to budge at all. You know, at one point, I think Trump said to Nancy Pelosi, look, if I fund government, we get up and running. Are you then going to, you know, negotiate? We get some funding for the wall. And she said, as I understand it, no. So why is that intransigent? What helps cause some of these issues that Democrats care about playing out? Why are Democrats so unyielding on something that is in some ways negotiable? Why is it a point of principle for them?
That's the key question, Dave. And I think we need to step back for a second because there's two things going on. There's the government shutdown and people are, you know, sort of feeling the effects of that. And that's very important. Then you have this fight over the wall. And as you said, you know, money-wise, in the grand scheme of things, it's not that much. What's really going on here, though, is not – the caller talked about sort of the tit-for-tat with what happened with President Obama. What's really going on here, though, is this is a symbolic fight over sort of the identity of who we are as a country. And that might sound grandiose, but this is really something that Trump ran on this wall during the campaign, and he talked about it, but it was a metaphor for a larger identity of make America great again and a vision that things had changed too much in the country, and people responded to that. There's no question about it. President Obama had a different point of view. He, as folks remember, gave a speech on immigration in 2014. Trump likes to compare him and say Trump gets unfavorable coverage by the media. Trump says that all the time, but Obama's speech at the White House at that point was not actually shown on network TV. But in that speech, Obama offered a path for about 4 million parents of immigrants to stay – immigrant parents to stay in the country. So what's really going on here is this bigger fight. That's what the wall stands for. And to answer your direct question, you know, Democrats say they tried to negotiate a year ago over the wall with Trump. They offered him some money then in exchange for legal status for over a million undocumented immigrants who came as children. And that deal collapsed. They said Trump wanted more. He wanted more hardline measures. And they now are saying that since then, he's separated children at the border. He's sent troops to the border. He is not to be trusted. And Democrats feel ascendant. And the liberal base and others are saying, look, we don't want to negotiate with President Trump here. He's not to be trusted on immigration issues. He's fanning unnecessary fears and he's inflating the idea that this is some sort of national security crisis. And I think for the Democrats to start off, you know, in this new era where they have a power in Washington in the House, they believe that there's nothing to negotiate really with President Trump right now. They want to reopen the government and then talk about immigration in a broader way.
We have a call now from Cheryl, New Mexico. Jake, thanks for calling in.
Hi there. I want to keep it brief. you know, my brother, he's been working at the border for almost his whole life now, and about 2 years ago, his life was taken by an illegal immigrant that crossed this border illegally. And I came here to tell you that we need this wall so that good people like my brother, his life won't be taken. Because people from another country just want to take everything from us. We need this wall. Need it.
Thank you for your call, Jake, and I'm so sorry for your loss. Of course, there are people who have invoked the question of crimes committed by people who have come in this country illegally. There are also a lot of studies that say in the aggregate, which doesn't provide much solace for those who have been subject to crimes, but that in the aggregate, actually, people in this country legally as immigrants and people in this country illegally as immigrants commit crimes and violent crimes on a lower level than native-born Americans. Natasha Bertrand, though, that's been a key part of the president's rhetoric. Is that not the case?
Exactly. And if you're – I mean, I don't want to diminish anyone's grief. I do think that is a problem. But if this has become a very potent talking point on the right, I mean, this has become something that Sean Hannity, for example, has devoted his entire program to over the last few days, is by talking to people he describes as angel moms and dads who have lost their children to violence by people who are here illegally. And that seems to be the most compelling way that they've discovered to make a case for this wall. And again, I don't want to diminish that, because, you know, no one should have to go through that. But there is data to support the fact that citizens of this country and people who are here legally commit crimes at a higher rate than people who are here illegally. So I don't, you know, necessarily think that is the thing that we should be hinging this policy on, especially because it seems to be very selective. I mean, you know, I don't see Sean Hannity talking about the angel moms and dads who have lost kids to gun violence, for example. So I do think that this is becoming the way that they're trying to sell this. And I think that people should also be wary of being used as political pawns in this.
One of the ways in which the President Trump has tried to sell this was a promise, seemingly, about a campaign pledge that Mexico would pay for the border wall. Yesterday, the president backpedaled a bit, and he said he didn't mean that the Mexican government would ever pay directly.
Mexico is paying for the wall indirectly. And when I said Mexico will pay for the wall in front of thousands and thousands of people, obviously they're not going to write a check. But they are paying for the wall indirectly many, many times over by the really great trade deal we just made.
I think it's worth listening to what the president actually had to say throughout his presidential campaign. And political rhetoric can sometimes change from public policy. But candidate Donald Trump insisted repeatedly that Mexico would pay for a wall along the southern border.
We're going to build a wall.
We will build a great wall.
We're going to build a great wall.
And Mexico will pay for the wall.
Mexico is going to pay for it, and they'll be happy to pay for it. The wall is going to be paid for by Mexico.
They don't know it yet, but they're going to pay for the wall.
We're going to make them pay for that wall.
But they're going to pay for the wall.
Trust me, Mexico will pay for it.
And I will have Mexico pay for that wall. Mexico is going to pay for the wall. Who's going to pay for the wall?
And credit to our producing team for putting that together on tight deadline there. But Jack Beatty, what do you make about that distance in between the president's campaign rhetoric and what he's saying in the last 24 hours?
Well, you know, it's part of the president's daily assault on rationality. If I said that yesterday, I'm going to say something else again today. He's like the character in the play with a whim of iron. He just switches whatever he wants, and his people go along with it. If I might, I just want to return very briefly to this, the president contemplating the national emergency. You know, students of comparative autocracy would be are kind of appalled at this moment because they look at the Weimar Constitution. There was an article in that, Article 48, that allowed presidents to rule by decree, emergency powers. It was used several times by the democratic governments during the Weimar years, and it was used decisively by Hitler after the Reichstag fire to create a national emergency and essentially to prevent the election of 1933 that might have cost him his slender hold on the chancellorship. Now, the real fear about this is a law professor writing in The Atlantic says that this emergency provision that law passed in 1976 could be our Article 48. She says some of these powers appear dangerously suited to a president, to a leader bent on amassing or retaining power. And she also fears that under the Insurrection Act, troops could be ordered to deploy to our cities. Now, what's the danger here? The danger is Trump does it here for this crisis. And what about the next crisis? What about the election of 2020? Does he go along with that or does he foment a crisis and have another national emergency? This is a dangerous, dangerous moment for the future of the American Republic.
Well, it's a step he has not yet taken, and if he were to exercise it, it would be on behalf of a more limited means. But as you say, it could be broadly expansive of powers if he doesn't get held up in court. I want to turn now to developments that, in some ways, the border funding crisis would seem almost perfectly scripted to distract us from. And that is the question of what happened in court, what revelations we've had, particularly about the president's former campaign chairman, Paul Manafort. Natasha Bertrand, you've been covering this a lot. What did we learn in these court filings about Paul Manafort's interaction with Russian figures during the 2016 elections?
Well, we accidentally learned that Paul Manafort, the president's campaign chairman, had actually given polling data, internal Trump campaign polling data, to Konstantin Kilimnik, who is suspected of having ongoing ties to Russian intelligence. And we learned that because of a redaction error by Paul Manafort's lawyers earlier this week in a response to the government's accusations that Manafort had been lying to them throughout his cooperation deal. So we learned essentially that Manafort had lied to the government about or had not disclosed to the government anyway that he had given this polling data to Kilimnik during the campaign. Of course, that raised a whole bunch of new questions. Why did he want that polling data to go to two Ukrainian oligarchs, which we learned that is why he gave the polling data to Kilimnik to pass along to two pro-Russian Ukrainian oligarchs during the election? What did they use that data for? And is there any possibility that ended up in the hands of the Russians, who then may have used it perhaps to target certain segments of the American population when they were interfering in the election? So it's a huge revelation. I hope that we will get more answers about it. But the fact that Paul Manafort lied about this is extremely telling.
I mean, the lie is a problem, right? You're being investigated by special counsel. This guy has prosecutorial powers of the U.S. government. You're trying to enter some sort of understanding about how long you're going to be going to jail. So you try to comply. And yet it turns out they say, well, you've lied. You know, I talked to a longtime Republican aide on the Hill, dealt with a number of issues. He's now no longer on the Hill. But he said to me yesterday, all right, they're sharing internal poll numbers. You know, this is the sort of thing the Associated Press and the Washington Post try to get all the time. Natasha Bertrand, what is the harm if that's what they're really sharing is poll numbers?
Yeah, it's extremely significant because poll numbers are not – it's not so much about who's ahead or who's behind. It's about finding out which subgroups in key states are persuadable and what arguments persuade them. So they try out a whole bunch of arguments to see which ones move people to a greater degree or a lesser degree. And Paul Manafort would know exactly what these poll numbers are useful for. It could be kind of a roadmap for anyone who wants to target ads to a specific segment of the population. So if anyone was going to be knowledgeable about power and value of such polling data, it would have been Paul Manafort. Now, we learned yesterday that the person who was doing the internal polling for the Trump campaign, Tony Fabrizio, he was actually interviewed by Mueller in, I believe, February of 2018. So this is clearly something that's been on Mueller's radar for almost a year now. And it could have substantial implications for how we understand how the Russians targeted Americans during the election.
Very briefly before a break, I want to play we have a clip of President Trump being asked about this revelation about his former campaign manager, Paul Manafort. Here's Trump speaking to ABC News' Jonathan Carl.
Do you know that Paul Manafort was sharing polling data from your campaign with the Russians?
No, I didn't know anything about it. Nothing about it.
David Nakamura, 10 seconds. Is this a concern at the White House or not?
Absolutely a concern. The White House beef up their legal team. But, you know, the president has been trying to sort of distance himself from Manafort, said he only worked for him for a short time, even though he was the chairman of the campaign. So, and the president has continued to deny that he had any knowledge of this, and you're going to just see him continue to say that.
The Colonel Klink defense, I know nothing. We're discussing the biggest stories of the week. You can join our conversation. We'll be talking about the withdrawal of American troops from Syria and U.S. policy in the Middle East. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered. But we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. You can join our conversation. What news story rocked your world this week? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests today are David Nakamura of The Washington Post, Natasha Bertrand of The Atlantic, and On Point's Jack Beatty. You know, obviously, we've been talking a little bit about Paul Manafort, the president's former campaign manager, and the special counsel, Robert Mueller's investigation into him, as well as other federal prosecutors. A lot of that is going to be determined by the leadership of the U.S. Justice Department. And Natasha Bertrand, we're hearing some changes about how things are going to play out. Obviously, William Barr has been nominated to be the next attorney general. And there's been talk about Rod Rosenstein stepping down as a deputy AG. Is it clear now whether or not he's going to stay on throughout the Mueller investigation? He's obviously been incredibly important to the insulation of that from political pressures.
According to the reporting that we've done and that we've read so far, it does seem like he's going to stay until the Mueller investigation is completely wrapped up or until it's wrapped up or almost completed sufficiently so that it cannot be meaningfully interfered with. I do think that there are serious concerns by Democrats about Bill Barr's nomination because, of course, he has expressed skepticism, to say the very least, about the Mueller probe's obstruction inquiry into the president. He wrote a 20-page memo last year outlining why he thought that that was not the right course of action that Mueller should be taking and that it was an overreach. And they are also concerned because Bill Barr signaled yesterday that he could not commit to making a Mueller report, the complete report anyway, public. And Senator Amy Klobuchar, you know, she was discussing this last night with reporters, and she said that that really disturbed her. So a lot of Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee that I've spoken to are saying that they believe that Bill Barr should recuse himself when he does take over because he is likely to be confirmed. But that, of course, is unlikely to actually happen because if Donald Trump's relationship with Jeff Sessions is any indication, he likely would have got assurances from Bill Barr that he's not going to recuse himself from the Mueller probe.
And David Nakamura, you know, we've heard these reports in recent days that because of the shutdown that Bill Barr couldn't meet with Senate Democrats to talk about their concern, at least most of them, ahead of his nomination process. What do we even make of that?
Yeah, that didn't seem to square with reality. And now that he's been pressured by some very high-ranking Democrats to be more forthcoming and available, he apparently is now doing that. And I think that's important for his nomination to go forward. You're seeing some Democrats say they've met with him now and they feel more comfortable. And Lindsey Graham has, you know, gone out there and said, of course, that that Barr will indeed commit to seeing through this Mueller investigation. And, you know, the idea, though, that, you know, how much of the report would be made public, you know, you see the president's legal team, and my colleague has written about this very recently, is beefed up with 17 new lawyers, and they're really preparing to make the case that Trump could be protected by executive privilege in some of his communications with senior officials, including at the Justice Department. I think they're trying to lay the groundwork to block certain damaging revelations that may be in the report from seeing the light of the day to the public and to Congress, for that matter.
I want to turn for now from the Department of Justice to Departments of State and Defense. We've seen in the last 24 hours reports that the first U.S. troops are starting to withdraw from Syria, the drawdown of the 2,000 troops that are there. And of course, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo just appeared in the Middle East, in Egypt, to make an address essentially disavowing much of President Obama's agenda, but also saying that talking about the importance of the American role there. Jack Beatty, what did you make of what Secretary Pompeo had to say?
Well, first of all, it was built around this sort of figment of conservative agitprop against the Obama administration. You know, it was the apology tour, right? That's what Obama was accused of doing in his Cairo speech of, I think 2009. He apologized for the United States. It was a shaming thing, Pompeo said. Of course, President Obama did no such thing. He tried rather to solve feelings in the Arab world, which were at a pitch because of the revelations about Abu Ghraib and the torture and the detention and all the rest. And he was dealing with that and saying this was not a great moment for the United States, and we're sorry about that, and we're going to do better. And in fact, opinion of the United States improved in the Arab world, I believe, after that. So the whole thing was just this. It was out of the Republican memory bank against Mr. Obama. And, of course, the idea that the U.S. was going to stay there and Obama was pulling the troops out. Well, of course, we read in the New York Times today, the troops are starting to come out of Syria. What did John Bolton say over the weekend? They're not coming out of Syria, not till we've contained Iran and dealt with Turkey and done. He had a whole bunch of reasons they weren't going to leave. They're leaving now, apparently, or starting to. So it's the chaos of this administration, the incompetence. The one guy says one thing, the other guy says the other thing, and the president is off in his own world.
Natasha Bertrand, let me pick up on the question of chaos that Jack raises. As we read it, the president of the United States was convinced to announce the withdrawal of troops from Syria abruptly, in part by a conversation he had with the leader of Turkey, who, as Jack points out, is now upbraiding John Bolton, the national security advisor, for saying, well, there'd be conditions and terms and delays and things like that. Where do we stand? Where have we allied ourselves in all this? And in light of our pullout from Syria, what is our standing going to be there?
There's going to be a vacuum. I think that this is a capitulation to Russia and to the Assad regime and in many ways to Turkey. But I think that the president just kind of listens to whoever was last in his ear. And in the case of withdrawing from Syria, it was clearly Erdogan. I do think that just the general chaos of our foreign policy is very, very evident in how we've dealt with the Syria crisis. As we said, I mean, Bolton completely rolled back the decision to rapidly withdraw from Syria. He said that American forces would remain there until the last remnants of ISIS were defeated, and Turkey provided guarantees that it would not strike Kurdish forces. So the fact now that we are without any more information, really, the Defense Department really is not giving us any more information about, you know, what, how many troops are being withdrawn, what the timeline is. Now we're hearing that they've already begun to be withdrawn, even though we haven't gotten those assurances from Turkey that they're not going to invade and attack our allies there.
So the rollback was rolled back in a sense, right?
The rollback was rolled back, yeah. And it just is demonstrative of how there's really no one who can advise the president. In the end, it's going to be his own impulses and his own whims that dictate our foreign policy.
Worth noting, of course, the Secretary of State Secretary of Defense, James Mattis, not so long ago resigned over this very issue. And there is no permanent nominee so far to take his place. Natasha, I want to drill down for a moment, though. I mentioned Turkey and the conversations that Trump had with the Turkish leader Erdogan about this as leading this. You instantly went to Russia. Why is Russia behind this? Why is it that Russia comes up in all the fever dreams that involve this administration?
It's a good question. But as we know, Russia has been in Syria for years and years, essentially working to prop up the Assad regime. And they want to be the predominant power in the Middle East. And they want to have this land bridge to the Mediterranean. And so the thing that we've seen, which is really ironic in this horrible, horrible war in Syria, is that the Assad regime and the Russians were really never interested in defeating ISIS. They were interested in defeating the rebels who were fighting the Assad regime. So with us pulling back, then Russia is free to fill that vacuum and prop up the Assad regime even further, especially because the Kurdish forces and the rebels were the ones really kind of battling not just the regime, but also ISIS. Why the president continues to capitulate to Russia and continues to do things that are favorable to Vladimir Putin is a question I think that we all want answered and that we expect to be answered in Mueller's final report, right? I mean, this question of whether or not he is compromised by the Russians lingers over virtually every foreign policy decision he's made, especially with regard to his comments about NATO, his comments about the European Union, just kind of weakening all of our traditional alliances and abandoning our allies, especially now the Kurds in the Middle East.
You know, if I could say something here.
Yeah, David, hop in.
Yeah, no, you know, the President Trump and his, you know, His feeling about things in, you know, around the he ran a campaign based on, you know, stamping out terrorism and direct threats to the United States. And, you know, he's making the case that the United States defeated ISIS on the battlefield. And even though that flies in the face of demonstrable evidence that has been presented by experts, the president is trying to make that case. And so when you look more broadly at what we're doing in the Middle East, the president doesn't believe in things, you know, certainly not nation building, not necessarily the spread of U.S. values and democracy. You know, he's saying, let's bring them home. And if it dovetails with what Vladimir Putin's interests are, the president's reasoning publicly is, well, we're trying to have a good working relationship with Russia. That when you look more broadly and step back for a second, you know, how does that message play around the world? The president's, you know, one of his biggest foreign policy gambits outside of Iran and is North Korea. And he's basically engaged with Kim Jong-un over this negotiation to try to convince the North to get rid of its nuclear arsenal. You know, what is Kim Jong-un seeing here? He's seeing that the president is undermining his national security advisor, John Bolton, who's been very hawkish against North Korea. And they see the president, you know, if you can get in his ear and convince him to take dramatic steps, he might just do it. And one of the North's biggest goals is to reduce U.S. troop presence on the Korean Peninsula. And you'll see maybe on a second summit, the North really pushing that to President Trump. And so he may not go that far, but this is, you know, what kind of message is he sending when his own national security advisors are on a completely different page?
You've seen Democrats feel a little resurgent and feeling their oats on the House side, you know, calling a number of hearings to look at various elements of some of the issues we've talked about. You're also seeing a number of senators pop their heads above the parapet to say they are interested in taking on Trump directly. We've spoken about Elizabeth Warren's interest in 2020, and now Kamala Harris, California senator, has said pretty clearly that she's interested in entering this race. Jack Beatty, where would she be among the possible contenders? What part of the Democratic Party and part of the nation might she be likely to appeal to?
Well, the Obama base, I think, of minority voters and young people, that's clearly the segment she would be answering for. She would be in the Democratic spectrum. She'd be the identity politics candidate, a woman, a minority, pitching to the sense that Trump has made life extremely difficult and such groups, and essentially half the population. And so that would be her niche in the scheme of things. There's one thing about her, though, that's really sort of striking to me. She has talked, at least, about a tax cut for middle-class Americans, just limited to middle-class Americans. This is a strange thing, I think, for a Democratic candidate to be talking about. Obviously, at the time of the deficit, as it's growing again, but also because this is the Republican politics. You know, we don't need the government. The Democrats. How does that fit in with this ambitious program, which I'm sure she subscribes to one degree or another? To have national health insurance, to have guaranteed jobs, to do all the rest. You can't cut taxes on the middle class and do all those other things. So it's a strange
a little more Bill Clinton than Elizabeth Warren.
Yes, precisely. That isn't part of the identity politics thing. Yeah.
Well, she David Nakamura. She is has interesting background, obviously, and a father who's an immigrant from Jamaica, mother who is of Indian descent, that is to say, Asian Indian descent, and very much yet, she came out as an attorney general, state of California, was a prosecutor, and she comes from a different part of the party than, say, some of the new resurgent and more liberal House members who won election this past year.
Absolutely. And she's, she's an interesting candidate, being from California, the leader of the sort of state that's putting up most of the resistance to President Trump and really fighting his policies on immigration, the environment, and so many other things. And, I think that she's, really sort of set herself up to, become a strong voice in this debate. In a way that other candidates might not be. I mean, she was very tough in a hearing I watched, on a confirmation hearing in the Senate for the new director of ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, and she was very, very critical and basically went so far as to say ICE, was scaring immigrants and in their own homes, even made the so almost seemed to suggest that ICE was so lawless that they were almost akin to the KKK, something that engendered a significant backlash.
She was tough also in the Kavanaugh hearings. Yeah,
she was. I mean, so you're seeing that basically Democrats ramp up their message. Those who have this ambitions, I think that in the case I was mentioning, there was significant backlash, and her team tried to suggest that it was mistaken. But these are things where people are trying to carve out important areas. There's a liberal wing that wants to abolish ICE, potential candidates are having to sort of strike a balance to satisfy that really passionate wing of the party, while also establishing some sort of middle ground and to sound, I guess, more appealing to some broader electorate.
And David Nakamura, in about the 30 seconds we have left, we heard from Senator Lindsey Graham earlier on this hour. I've heard from some reporters, too. They say they think the president's ability to get funding for the wall and claim a victory will have almost a direct effect on his prospects for his 2020 reelection campaign. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, I've been sort of treating the wall as like a sort of a, something we keep coming back to and writing about, as almost like a figure, almost a, another a cabinet official in the way that you want to keep writing about it as an issue, mm-hmm. because it's so important. It's so ingrained and connected to President Trump's campaign and his promises to the public. And, I think in talking to folks over time, conservatives, border hawks and others, they do see the wall as important, whether it's symbolic or a real, actual wall. They think it's something that President Trump has to deal with.
A talisman for the president.
Absolutely. And so I think he recognizes that, and that's where we are.
David Nakamura, White House reporter for The Washington Post. May your sources never give you the Heisman.
Thank you.
Natasha Bertrand, staff writer for The Atlantic. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Jack Beatty, On Point's news analyst. Have a great weekend, Jack.
Thank you, David.
You can subscribe to the On Point newsletter right on our homepage, onpoint.radio.org. You'll get weekly messages from me and my colleague Meghna Chakrabarty. This week, you'll have a chance to weigh in with your thoughts on the government shutdown. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Madeline D'Angelo, Justine Daum, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Allison Poli, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, and Alex Schroeder, with help from David Marino. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Thank you for joining us here on Folk and Flick Fridays. I'm David Folk and Flick, and this is On Point.